From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll look back at yesterday's Foxconn groundbreaking.
Then the Canadian Consul General takes issue with President Trump's claim in Wisconsin that the economic playing field is tilted in favor of Canada.
There are absolutely no facts that would support that. And he doesn't raise any.
Wisconsin researchers are developing an app to help understand why Lyme disease is on the rise here.
Just a little bit of a difference in the biology of the tick is making a big difference in where we see disease.
Bubbler Talk explains why the bridges over Milwaukee's rivers go up so often.
The way that the regulations are currently written is that the rivers were here first, so the river technically has the right of way.
And we'll hear an in-studio performance from Milwaukee musician Joe Richter.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It was a landmark day for the Taiwanese company Foxconn and supporters of its plan to build a nearly $4 billion factory in Racine County. A large group of dignitaries, including the company's CEO, President Donald Trump, and Governor Scott Walker, were on site in Mount Pleasant for the ceremonial groundbreaking for the factory.
The president's appearance also drew protesters in several locations around the region and included a fundraiser earlier in the day in Milwaukee. WUWM's Mayan Silver was on site for the groundbreaking, and she joins us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So you were at this groundbreaking in Mount Pleasant, as were a lot of other media folks. But besides the press, who else was there?
So there were about 50 dignitaries from Wisconsin and elsewhere who came to see President Trump, Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, and Foxconn officials break the ground at the Foxconn plant. And actually, Tommy Thompson, the former governor, was there. And he said that the 10,000-plus jobs that Foxconn was presenting was transformational. That's the word he used. He said it's an opportunity that Wisconsin can't pass up.
I can't think of a state in America that if Foxconn came to those states and said, would you make an investment if we make an investment of this size? I'm here to tell you that I'm no governor's, been one. Every governor would have said yes. So every state would have approved this thing.
So that's former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson speaking. There have been reports out in recent days that Foxconn is scaling down this factory. It's going to be a different grade of factory, and it's going to make smaller screens than originally the screens that they talked about. What did people at the groundbreaking have to say about that development?
Right. That's exactly right. So it's possible that it could be a Generation 6 plant instead of a Generation 10.5 plant. State officials basically said it wasn't up to the government to tell Foxconn how to run their businesses. So we talked to Mark Hogan. He's from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. He explained what the state of Wisconsin is expecting from Foxconn.
WEDC's contract and the contract for the state of Wisconsin is about 13,000 jobs. It's about $10 billion investment. And it is about an average salary of $53,185. And everything else, those are the three pillars of our contract.
That's Mark Hogan of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Now, this is potentially a lot of employees, and I know you and a lot of other people were stuck for a long time on Interstate 94 going through Racine County. What did people there say about the issue of transportation and how these workers are likely to get to and from the Foxconn factory?
So transportation is definitely something that the state officials were responding to. Ellen Nowak, who is Secretary of the Department of Administration for Governor Walker, says that they're looking for solutions, but she wasn't really specific about what the solutions were. Tim Sheehy is president of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce, and he was more specific.
You cannot have 13,000 people working here driving in traditionally the way we do it in a car and driving out. So transportation and options to get here are going to be critical.
And what are some of those plans, like with public transportation? Is there going to be a regional transit authority or anything like that?
Well, I think the opportunities are that you could run a flexible but direct bus service here. I don't think rail options are excluded. And then as we start to develop, the potential of autonomous vehicle lane is another way to get people to and from the facility.
Sheehy also said that he was aware and paying attention to the fact that the 53206 zip code and other areas in the central city don't have a lot of jobs, have high unemployment rates. And so he said that there are groups that are paying attention to training opportunities. But then he also said that Racine has invested $1.5 million in training, and there's opportunities with Gateway Technical College, UWM, and others.
Now, Mayan, there's an irony here. We've been talking about this by my clock about 3 minutes and 45 seconds here. That's somewhat longer than the actual groundbreaking, right?
That is correct.
What did it look like?
Basically, there was a big field, and there was a large American flag in the background. There were about 5 golden shovels lined up and a lot of press. And essentially, the whole thing lasted about 45 seconds.
The group marched out there. They took their shovels, dug the ceremonial dirt, and walked off.
Exactly.
No one said anything.
No. And a few notable things about the space. There were no protesters at the site because law enforcement, local law enforcement and Secret Service had cleared away the area. But when you were driving through the area, you would see a few houses with signs protesting the eminent domain because they didn't want their houses taken over for the Foxconn property.
Mayan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You can hear full coverage of yesterday's groundbreaking and the subsequent speech by President Trump at WUWM.com.
The president gave an extended speech at Foxconn's Opus building following the groundbreaking. The speech ran the gamut of topics ranging from Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's imminent retirement to trade tariffs with other countries. Trump singled out Canada in particular.
We're going to be treated fairly when our great farmers in Iowa, Wisconsin, Upper New York State, when we want to sell our dairy products into Canada, they charge us 275%. 275%! Essentially, what they're saying is we don't want your product. Because who's going to pay that? So we're going to level out the playing fields, folks. They send us a lot of stuff. No tax. We're going to work it out. It's going to be friendly. We love Canada. We love Canada. I love Canada. But we're going to work it out.
By coincidence, Canada's Consul General to the Midwest was in Milwaukee yesterday. John Cruickshank stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk about the state of trade relations between the two countries. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you think, are these unprecedented times for U.S.-Canadian relations right now?
No. They're difficult times. They're turbulent times. But we've been through a lot together. And just as recently as the Nixon period, when you guys went off the gold standard, immediately placed 10% tariffs on everything coming over the border, it was shocking, and it changed everything. So we've been through it, we've had ups and downs with free trade together too. As a matter of fact, one of the times you threw us out as free trade neighbors was just after the Civil War. And you apparently didn't like the fact that we were doing some trading with the rebels. So it goes. History is long.
Long and fairly interesting. Just in the recent hours as we're having this conversation, President Trump gave a speech following the groundbreaking at the new Foxconn factory just south of Milwaukee, in which he talked about tariffs and trade and brought up Canada in particular, as he has done several times in recent days, and his desire to, in his words, level the playing field. Given the evolving trade situation between the two countries, what do Canadian people and companies think when they hear rhetoric like that?
They think that this is negotiating tactics. They think that he is as he's known to have in the past to overstate a case in order to reach a desired end.
And what do you think of the notion that the playing field is not level?
There are absolutely no facts that would support that, and he doesn't raise any. We've had fair and extraordinarily balanced trade under NAFTA, and prior to that under the FTA, the free trade agreement that we originally did back in the 80s. It's been of great benefit to both sides. When you look at the growth rates for both countries during that period, they've been very, very similar. So It's very hard to say that there's been something unbalanced about it, because there's just nothing in the numbers that suggests that.
One of the examples that gets pointed to time and again is the Canadian tariff on U.S. dairy products, which dairy farmers in Wisconsin in particular say unfairly discriminates against them. Where does Canada see that issue?
When we did the free trade agreement and then when we did NAFTA, there were some carve-outs that were done. And we said in those two sets of negotiations, look, we have a managed system for dairy. We want to make sure that we protect the family farm, and we also want to make sure that consumers are protected from big swings in the price of milk and other goods. And the U.S. negotiators said, okay, sure, but you're going to have to pay for that. And we did, right? We did at the table. You have extremely high tariffs on, you know, on peanuts and on sugar, and you know. So this is a deal we made,
So you're saying, and I apologize for interrupting. You're saying the 270% tariff can't be looked at in a vacuum.
We paid for it, right? We paid for it. If you look at the overall tariff level in Canada as compared to the overall tariff level in the U.S., Canada's slightly lower than the U.S., right? And we came down from a higher level than you did. So we gave more when we signed the deal, but we did it with our eyes open, and you did it with your eyes open. And the fact that the president has seized on this and said, boy, this is unfair, these tariff levels, is it simply misrepresents what went on. Now, I think he's confusing a couple of things. There have been complaints from Wisconsin farmers about the hyper-filtered milk or ultra-filtered milk. There are no tariffs and there are no quotas on that milk. So their complaint is really that the market has begun to shift there.
What does the complete picture of trade between Wisconsin and Canada look like, including dairy, but the whole picture?
Well, just go to dairy, and Wisconsin has about a 5-to-1 advantage or surplus in dairy sales. So Wisconsin does very well. And overall, Wisconsin does very well, has a very substantial surplus with Canada. And it has that in almost every area, including services. So it's a very good deal. Canadians are your very best customers, we keep saying don't beggar your customer, because you're the one who's going to get hurt in the end if you do that.
Well, and I know it was just this week that Canadian business leaders met with members of parliament to talk about the impact of tariffs on steel and aluminum. There are some who say the next step in this kind of escalating situation could be Canada levying new tariffs on things like American coal. What do you see as the likelihood of that happening?
Well, I sure hope we don't get into a tit for tat. But the reality is that the steel and aluminum tariffs have been slapped on Canada. They are illegal. I mean, they're not permitted either under the agreements that were made under the WTO, which was, after all, to a large extent, an American invention, and we've signed on for, as America clearly did. Those rules prohibit the use of the national security clause in the way that they're presently being used. And they're also not permissible under the NAFTA agreement. There will be a deliberation. These things will go to some form of tribunal, and the U.S. will be found to have violated its own laws. So what Canada has done is said, all right, we don't like this, but we're going to take some countervailing measures, absolutely equal. To what's happening to Canadian goods. And we need to do that to protect our factories. We need to do it to protect our workers. And those measures will come down the instant these unfair tariffs are taken off.
So it could be coal.
It could be coal. It could be any number of things. It will certainly be steel and aluminum, no question about that. And there's a terrible irony in some of this, and especially be especially clear in Wisconsin, an awful lot of the steel and aluminum that comes down here from Canada, which will now be tariffable, is fabricated here and then sold back to Canadians. But the prospect of it being sold back at 25% or 10% increases in costs really, you know, are reduced. And that means that the real victims are going to be people of Wisconsin.
Consumers.
Yeah. Absolutely. But in this case, it's interesting because what's happening already here is that your steel prices and aluminum prices are rising here despite the fact that your producers aren't facing any tariffs. They're rising because you've put the tariffs on. So that means for every business, you're not only going to be taking the expense of tariffed goods from Canada, you're going to be taking the expense from all of the steel going up here, all of the aluminum going up. And that means for everything you build for yourselves, it's going to be that much more expensive.
Consul General John Cruickshank, thank you so much for your perspective.
A great pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
John Cruickshank is the Consul General of Canada to the Midwest, based in Chicago. He was in Milwaukee yesterday for a Canada Day reception at the Milwaukee School of Engineering's Grohmann Museum.
We'll take a short break now and then learn what researchers are investigating about Lyme disease and its epidemic in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Several parts of the United States are seeing a veritable epidemic of Lyme disease, the tick-borne illness. Unfortunately, one of those places is Wisconsin, where diagnoses of Lyme disease have increased significantly in recent years. While that much is known, there are many questions that are as yet unanswered about why the disease is prevalent here and in some parts of the East Coast.
A new smartphone app developed by researchers at UW-Madison may shed light on the answers. Susan Paskowitz is chair of the entomology department at UW-Madison and one of the researchers behind the Tick app. She talked with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about this latest research and the history of Lyme disease in Wisconsin.
The first case was probably back in the 1960s, and that was a human case where it was really obvious from the description of the symptoms of this person that he had Lyme disease, although they didn't call it that. It took a few years before Lyme was discovered in Old Lyme, Connecticut, so that was the middle 1970s. And then a few more years past that into about the early 1980s before we realized what the disease agent was and that the ticks were really important in terms of transmission. And a lot of that work was done on the East Coast, but of course we have the same ticks here, and so it was about that time in the early 1980s that we realized that our ticks also were infected and that people, more people than we had known, were getting sick.
So one of the questions I have just about Lyme disease in general is really, why do our ticks here in Wisconsin, in the East Coast, why do they have Lyme disease while those in the South and some other places, they don't?
Right, so that's a really wonderful and interesting biological story because it is the same tick. We call them Ixodes scapularis, the scientific name, or the black-legged tick, or the deer tick is probably more familiar to people in Wisconsin. And certainly deer ticks are really abundant here in the upper Midwest and Wisconsin and Minnesota and also along the East Coast, you know, now all the way up into Maine and really converging now. So we're starting to see them in lots of places where they didn't used to be, you know, Michigan, Indiana, and so on. But they also occur down in the southern United States. The difference seems to be that the behavior of this tick down there where it's hotter and drier is different from the behavior up here. And that may have a genetic component, so there may be some things that are about the populations that are a little bit different. But what we see is that up here, the immature stages, the nymphal stages, and the larval stages are going to be up sitting on the grass and the vegetation waiting for a host to come by, and then they're going to grab that host. And so they're just out there, you know, waiting for us to brush up against them. In the South, they just don't see that. When they go out and try to collect the ticks, they're not up. They're not actively looking in that same kind of way. What we think is they're probably down in the leaf layer, actually moving around more underground where it's more humid and looking for things like lizards that are buried down in there at night and feeding on down. So just a little bit of a difference in the biology of the tick is making a big difference in where we see disease.
So tell me a bit about the TIC app. When did this project start?
Well, this is a collaboration between the Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease here in the Upper Midwest and the Northeast Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, which is housed in Cornell. But our primary partners out there are actually some researchers at Columbia, and they started developing an app a couple years ago. We then began talking with them about some possibilities for joint projects comparing Lyme transmission in their area and in our area, and realized that they had felt that their app development was a fail. They only had, I think, 10 or 11 people who picked up the app, and we thought that maybe with some of the resources here at UW-Madison, we could develop something that would be a little bit more appealing to people. And indeed, with the rollout of the app already, I think we've got several hundred people who've signed up for it, so we're really pleased about that.
What kind of things does the app ask of participants? How do you participate with the app?
Yeah, so the app is designed as a research tool, but it's also designed as an educational tool. And so when you download the app, the first thing that will happen is you'll be asked to sign a consent form. So it will describe what's going to happen in terms of surveys and information we're going to collect. You sign off on that. And then you will do a kind of a pre-survey where we ask questions about the kind of properties, features of your property, aspects of your pets, what kind of activities you do outside. So you fill out this pre-survey, which for a lot of us has only taken about 5 or 10 minutes to do. And then what happens is each day for a period of about 2 weeks in the peak transmission season, which is right now, you're going to get a reminder at the end of the day to fill out a tick diary. And that tick diary will ask you whether you encountered a tick, and if you did, then you go on and answer a few more questions about what you were doing and where you were when you encountered that tick. And if not, then you say no and you're all done, so just a few seconds that way. The other thing that is part of this is that if people should get a tick on their person and they want to report it outside of that diary window, we do have a report a tick function. So you can go in and take a picture, you can send it to us, and you can tell us what you were doing again when you picked that tick up. And that could be really valuable as we're trying to understand more about people's activity and the environments in which they're being exposed to Lyme and the other pathogens transmitted by these deer ticks.
Yeah, what kind of information do you hope to glean from this? I mean, you were just saying, you know, activities that people are doing, where they might be when they see these ticks. What can we learn from knowing these things?
I think one of the things we're hoping is to do this comparison with the East Coast, because traditionally there, you know, they've really thought that people are getting sick as a result of exposure in their own backyards. And that's really different. You know, when I first came to Wisconsin, the idea was that you went to your cabin up in the Northwoods, and maybe you were hiking or fishing or clearing brush on your property, and those were the kinds of activities that were quite different here from what people there were experiencing. We're not sure that that's true, and we really could use the help of people in Wisconsin now sharing with us more about where they're finding deer ticks. So this is one of our core goals, is to try to understand, are you picking them up when you're mowing the grass? Could you possibly be encountering deer ticks when you're out there working in your garden, whether it's a vegetable garden or ornamentals? Maybe it is when you're out there working along the edge and doing brush clearing in your property is a place where you might be at higher risk. But those are the kinds of things where we would really hope to get more information, because that would then help us think a lot more about how are we going to control transmission of disease. If it's on your property, we have ways then that we can think about trying to implement. If you're getting exposed solely as a result of hiking in our wonderful Northwoods, then we have to do really different things, because we're obviously not going to go out and do treatments in the woods. That's going to be much more than a personal an education on what people need to do every day to protect themselves.
So recognizing that we're still at really in kind of the beginning stages of this project, is there anything that we've learned so far?
You know, one of the things that we've been doing to implement the app is going out and talking a lot more with people. So we're ecologists and biologists, and a lot of what we do is go out and collect ticks, and we collect small mammals, and we don't interact so much with the public. But this app has kind of put us out of our comfort zone a little bit. We've gone out and worked with several communities in central Wisconsin, up near Minocqua and over in Eau Claire, down closer to the Madison area. And what we're finding is that people are really interested in receiving information about ticks and in helping us, you know, in participating. So they recognize the problem and they want to be a part of trying to figure out what some of the solutions might be.
So when you are talking to people about ticks, what do you tell them about avoiding them, about places where they might be hanging out?
Right. So, you know, from our work, I think the places where we think the highest risk are will be in wooded areas because these ticks are really susceptible to drying out. So if you are in woods and you're walking down the hard pack on a trail, you're fine. You know, usually there aren't going to be a lot of ticks out in that kind of environment. As soon as you step off into the grass and the weeds a little bit on the side, though, then the deer ticks can be much more abundant in those locations. So I give people those kinds of warnings and then talk a bit about, you know, tucking your pants in your sock or using a repellent. You know, an insect repellent can be very helpful in that environment. There are also ways that you can treat your clothing. And very importantly, just remembering that at the end of the day, you need to take a shower and do that very careful tick check to look for them, because that's the primary thing that we would hope, right, is that you can get it off before it ever has a chance to transmit disease to you.
And if you have been bitten by a tick, what do you suggest people do?
So that's very dependent on how long the tick has been attached, and it's very dependent on what kind of tick it is. One of the things we're learning is that, you know, while many people are able to tell the difference between a deer tick and a wood tick, not everybody. So people are sending us pictures through the tick app, and sometimes we're realizing that these are actually wood ticks, and so there's no real worry with those in terms of disease transmission. So that's a good thing, right? But if you have the other tick on your person, if it is a deer tick, and it's been on for 24 hours, 36 hours, then you have this potential for Lyme transmission. If it's been on for shorter periods, there still is potential for transmission of other diseases. They have a couple of choices then. You can be very careful and alert for symptoms over the next couple of weeks and go see your physician immediately. In that case, I would actually save the tick and take it with me so they would know what you were exposed to. Or you can go and talk to your doctor right away, because sometimes it's appropriate to get a prophylactic treatment of antibiotics. In other words, a preventative treatment of an antibiotic if you've had a tick attached for a 24 to 36-hour period.
Going back to the tick app, when do you hope to have more concrete results from the project?
So we should start analyzing data probably by the end of July. So we're in the peak period of data collection now, and over the next, say, 4 weeks. Usually we still see a lot of tick activity into the first couple weeks in July, and it begins to tail off a bit after that. So hopefully around the first part of August we'll start doing some analysis. We're all very curious, so we can barely stand not looking at the data yet just to see what might be emerging. But we are receiving a lot of pictures from people, because that's one of the functions of the app, is that you can take a picture and send it to us for an identification and some advice. And that's been a really interesting process as well. So we're already kind of analyzing what we're seeing with that.
Nice. Well, I look forward to seeing more of the results from the app. And Susan, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much for letting me get the word out.
Susan Paskowitz is chair of the entomology department at UW-Madison and one of the researchers behind the Tick app. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you'll find a link to more about her research and the app at WUWM.com.
Another short break, and then Bubbler Talk explores the mysterious world of Milwaukee's lift bridges. When Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you live, work, or drive through downtown Milwaukee, chances are your route has been interrupted by this sound. Listener Kate Reardon's bike ride was once interrupted by a bridge lifting, and she noticed something that caught her interest and inspired this week's Bubbler Talk.
As the boat was approaching the next bridge, it kind of seemed like the bridge was not going up. So I was wondering, how exactly do the bridges work? Is it something the boat communicates to the bridge? Is there a person in there watching? Is it some kind of sensor?
To find out, I met with James Washington from the Department of Public Works at the Michigan Street Bridge House.
Yes. Yes, that would be me. I'm James Washington.
Nice to meet you, James.
Yes, here.
The Michigan Street Bridge is one of 21 movable bridges throughout Milwaukee. They cross the Menominee, Kinnickinnick, and Milwaukee rivers. And if you've ever noticed the towers attached to the bridges, there's actually a person in some of them.
That would be Broadway, Water Street, Michigan, and Kinnickinnick. Of those four bridges, most of the other bridges are operated remotely.
Milwaukee has two different types of bridges that lift. A vertical or tabletop bridge moves directly up and down, similar to a lift you would see in a mechanic's garage.
There's a electric motor that's connected to a large hydraulic pump, and they activate the cylinder, which actually lifts the jacking beams. These are beams that support the entire lift span on each side of the river.
The other type of bridge is a bascule, the classic drawbridge style in which two platforms open in the middle to let boats pass. Routine yearly maintenance for all the bridges involves greasing, maintaining oil, and maintaining the hydraulic system. All the bridges need overhauls every 40 to 45 years, which is why the Wells Street Bridge is currently closed. But back to Kate Reardon's question. How do they decide when to open the bridges? Clearance under the bridges range from 10 to 24 feet, and that can change from one day to the next.
One of the main limiting factors is the level of the river. And if we have a big snowfall in winter or heavy rainfall, the river levels could be higher.
What doesn't change is that the bridges open whenever a boat needs to pass through.
The way that the regulations are currently written is that the rivers were here first, so the river technically has the right of way.
According to the city, there were 23,000 bridge openings last year alone. With so many openings, the sound of the warning bell can cause some anxiety for drivers and pedestrians alike. Kate Reardon shares one particular memory.
I remember as a child, my family would do the Miller Bride for the Arts, and we would bike from our car to the starting point, and I was always terrified of the bridges because I thought that they would just start going up while I was on there, and I'd be stuck in the middle and fall into the river.
The DPW's James Washington says Kate and everyone can rest assured that won't happen.
Sometimes you'll have someone that starts to cross the bridge as we're getting ready to turn the bells on. If that happens, we do allow those people to pass. So there's not going to be an incident where you'd be walking and all of a sudden the bridge start raising and you go sliding down.
Right. So now that we know how the bridges work and there's no need to worry about getting stuck on a rising bridge, we just need to have a little patience so that we all can get where we need to go, whether by land or by water.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
One more break, and then Milwaukee musician Joe Richter joins us in the studio ahead of his big gig tomorrow at the Big Gig. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Beside me there's a happy soul. Something that I never had long ago.
Milwaukee musician Joe Richter's early work includes time with some area cover bands and his own acoustic albums. But his latest release, Revival, is his first produced album with a full band behind him.
If the new album weren't exciting enough, Richter has a coveted spot at the Big Gig. His Summerfest show is scheduled for tomorrow at 3 on the Johnson Controls World Soundstage. We invited him into the studio to give us a preview.
He's giving me the words to this song. I got love, I got so many, and I got everything more than just a penny. I got happy tears down my face running. I got everything a man's ever wanted. I got love. I got love. I got love. I got love. Yeah, yeah, 'cause I got someone from the devil that's been knocking me down, but nothing can can hurt me cause I got love all around. I got somebody from the devil that's been knocking me down. But nothing can hurt me cause love's all around me.
Joe Richter playing Happy Tears in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Joe, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm curious, what's your first memory of music that first sparked your interest in performing yourself?
Wow. Well, for some reason when I was a kid, I had a fascination with Elvis. And I don't know why, but I was a big fan of his music, mostly his voice. So I guess it was just... recalling when I was younger, just being a big fan of Elvis and hearing his music. And then, of course, following that, you know, I discovered Billy Joel. And that's kind of when everything, that's when I really decided that I wanted to do music.
Was there ever, you know, a family member or anyone that introduced you? Or was it just kind of self-exposure to things Billy Joel?
Yeah, I mean, my aunt took me to tons of concerts when I was a kid. So I'm very grateful for that. She took me, I was probably, this is probably before 10 years old, I went and saw Rod Stewart at the Marcus Amphitheater. We went and saw Billy Joel, we saw Springsteen. She introduced me to a lot, like Jackson Brown and Van Morrison. So it was a lot of the singer-songwriters before my time that really inspired me. So yeah, she was a pretty big influence in my music career. So
when did you decide to start learning an instrument? Did you learn guitar first?
I learned piano first. I probably started when I was about 8, and believe it or not, the piano I started when I was about maybe 41 keys. My brother actually got it for Christmas one year. I was extremely jealous, and so he got that, but he never played it, you know. So I'm like, let me just, you know, wipe the dust off this thing and start playing it. And there's a little chord book that came with it. And I remember seeing John Cougar Mellencamp, Pink Houses. Okay. So I started doodling that song and learning chords, because I think that song is like G and C pretty much. So I started learning that, and from there, you know, it just took off.
Right. You're kind of a blend of Americana, folk pop, rock with your songwriting. Does the lyric lend itself to you, or the musical style first?
The musical style, always. That's how it is for me, and I never write a lyric before I write a melody. I always write a melody first, and then comes a lyric, because I believe that sometimes you don't even need a lyric, you know? Sometimes the song will just take you where it wants to go, and then, you know, the listener can just decide what they want it to be about, you know? But the music guides me. It guides me where I want the song to go and what I want the song to be about, and then I think about it and I say... Yeah, just like the Happy Tears, you know. I mean, the music came before the lyric in that. So it's just a happy, happy little melody, as my Bob Ross.
Yeah, said. I was just thinking.
Happy, happy little melody.
I had a nice little chord over here.
Yeah, exactly.
Your album is called Revival, but yeah. I'm curious, what kind of revival is it for you?
Well, you know, it's kind of a, as I look back, from the time that I started actually writing music to now, and how my music has grown over the years, and not just my music, but me as a person, and the things that I've been through in life, and how I've overcome adversity, and how I have, you know, become a better musician over the years. And so I decided to title it Revival, because initially we were going to have a gospel revival on the record, which would have been super awesome. And I'm still thinking that's going to be a goal for my next record. But so I'm thinking gospel revival. And then I think about revival and what it means, you know. And that's, I decided to title it Revival. So, yeah, that in a nutshell.
You know, what components of your songs or messages did you feel could not have as great of an impact in an acoustic album version? Or was it just production goal?
There's a couple that I really couldn't imagine doing acoustic. Love Ain't For Me which is really creates the, I mean, it sounds like it is a gospel revival. I mean, with the organ, you know, the Hammond B3 organ in there, and then the guitar, the rock guitar, and you know, and then you've got Happy Tears, which Willie Porter played on, which creates a fantastic, you know, lead guitar lick at the end. Just blows me away still every time I listen to it. It's hard to imagine actually all these songs just as an acoustic piece. And, you know, I really wanted to go away from that on this record because I did it already. You know, it's been done. So now I wanted to branch out and create a full band record. So some of these songs could have done acoustic, but for what they are and what the record is, I'm really, really proud that we decided to do it this way. Yeah.
And as for, you mentioned what the record is, mm-hmm. did you go into that saying, here's my goal of this new record, this is what I want in it? And what do you feel that was missing in your music before then that you wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, well, I mean, what was really important to me was having the right musicians. You know, I had a vision, and I've always, any song that I write, I picture a band. I knew that from the get-go. So I had to reveal that vision to the musicians as to what I wanted, and they executed it wonderfully. And of course, when you're going to do that, you want to make sure you got the right guys. And the guys that I had on the record, I've been, you know, friends with for such a long time. And they were ecstatic that finally we're doing an original record now of your own stuff, not just covers, but originals. And not to say during the process it wasn't difficult. I mean, you know, sometimes when you're in the studio and you're trying to capture, you know, the song, it's always what's best for the song. And the guys know that. And sometimes it just takes a little bit more communication to do that. But we did it, you know. And so that was really important to me that, you know, when you're talking about the song, for example, like Just to Stay Alive, track 6 on the record is probably one of the most important songs to me because it's just a time in my life that, and I'm going to play it, actually. I just decided I'm going to play
Excellent.
It, yeah. But a time in my life that, you know, a time of darkness that I had to overcome, a time in my life where I just needed to change, you know. And the song is about change, hitting a bottom and then overcoming it and getting back on your feet. And I know a lot of people have difficulties with that. So I wanted to make sure that I captured that musically. And we did, you know. So that was a long-winded answer.
That's okay. Yeah. Let's transition it right into a song.
Sounds good.
Under the sun, on a beautiful day, my feet in the sand, but I can't run away. It should be so pretty, but it should feel so good. Just take me to a place where it's all understood. Where it's all understood. The leaves on the trees are such a sweet sound. Birds in the sky, flying all around. You could see me smile, but you could feel me lie. In a day to come, it's all an alibi. It's all an alibi. On a pure insanity. I take a look around and nothing's clear to me. I'm drowning in my tears, I'm falling on the shore. My mind's become delusional, Lord. Darkness fills my mind, a long timeline, constantly justifying all the reasons why. And though it's plain to see that this world I'm in, it keeps getting worse before I begin. Crosses my mind, this fear I seem to find, still yet so inside my soul, I'm screaming, no, no. Can there be a better life for a man undignified, for a man that craves to love just to stay alive, just to stay alive, just to stay alive, just to stay alive, yeah. Oh, no, 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 no.
Joe Richter performing Just to Stay Alive in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. You mentioned Willie Porter among the people who helped you with this album.
Yeah.
And he has a good quote about you. It says, mm-hmm. quote, Joe's got a strong and unique voice and sings like he means what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's a lack of authenticity in music that's out today? Or transparency between the singer, songwriter, the lyrics, and what's the final product?
It's definitely what I look for. You know, that's definitely what I look for in a song. The performance, ultimately, you know. So music today is just different, you know. And I hate saying that because I'm not a very old person.
Right.
So, it's hard to say, well, music back then was different. I mean, it's I've always listened to older music, you know. And it's not that I don't want to listen to today's music. But I do think there is a lack of it, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I just feel it. But for me, it's important for me to come across as just original, as how I see it, and as what my experience is, and in telling the story while I perform it. And every time I play my songs, I just want to capture, like, I'm going back to the time that I wrote it. Because in the moment when I wrote the songs is exactly how I feel at that particular moment. So it's kind of my goal that when people are listening to the song, it's in the moment, you know, so because it's in their moment.
Try to not dilute it as much as possible from start to finish.
Yeah, and if you listen to the record, everything is authentic. I mean, it's real. They're real musicians playing real musical instruments, you know, so... authenticity, yeah. Originality. Is that a word?
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Americana, singer-songwriter type stuff, that's just what I want. And that's what I've always listened to. You know, Van Morrison, Jackson Browne, you don't really hear much. From the 1970s. Yeah, that's kind of what I want to recapture for people.
So that would be, say, your ultimate goal in writing music with each song you compose.
Yeah, right now, I think, you know. Yeah, I think. But, you know, things could come... people can have ideas in the studio. And they say, well, let's try it this way. like many of these songs on this record, like the Just a Stay Alive song, I originally wanted to perform that song just with acoustic guitar in the beginning and have the band come in during the second verse. And John Wheeler, which is the guy that produced the record, said, no, man, let's bring the band in the front. So we did that. And I was like, okay, well. And that's another thing that I really need to keep in mind, to have an open mind and have other ideas, you know, people come forward with other ideas as to, let's try this instead. I needed to be open to that, and I'm just grateful that I was, so.
Well, and good that the final product still remained with your core goal, despite your name on the album, your artistry, but yet having a multitude of people be instrumental in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Joe, I'd like to thank you for coming in today and sharing your story and some of your music, and what would you like to play our listeners out with?
I'm going
to
go ahead and play It Was Over. There's a heart that needs love, 'cause it's been broken apart. It's a love that could.
Milwaukee musician Joe Richter's latest album is called Revival. He'll play tomorrow at Summerfest at 3 p.m. on the Johnson Controls World Soundstage. You can find more songs he performed for us and more information about him at WUWM.com. Our in-studio performance was engineered by Jason Reavy.
Jason is just one of a whole cast of characters behind this show. Mitch and I produce the show along with Bonnie North and Joy Powers, plus production assistance from Maddie Andre.
We are immeasurably helped by our interns, Ben Benversi, Gabby Powell, Lauren Keene, and Robin DiGiacinto.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow afternoon at 3 for another Lake Effect, this time weekend edition, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh Air is next.
Well, the days are long, oh no, they seem like years. I wish I could be happy, but she just disappeared. And I know that I'm the one she'll never love.